It's Thursday, July 8th. In a country that's not shocked by anything anymore, the unthinkable has happened. We start here. The president of Haiti is assassinated in his own home.
People are afraid to leave their homes right now.
After earthquakes, hurricanes, and violence, Haitians ask whether their leaders can keep anyone safe. Meanwhile, gunfire rings out back here in the States.
Our police officers are under siege.
Across the country, shootings are targeting civilians and the police sworn to protect them. And forget COVID, the recipe for every vaccine might be about to change.
With an mRNA vaccine, you can whip it up literally in a day.
From cancer to the old-fashioned flu shot, four letters have launched a revolution. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. We like to think of democracy as a permanent thing. It's an ideal, right? Once you got it in your country, it can't just go away. But earlier this year, we saw how quickly that changed in Myanmar.
An apparent military coup erased Myanmar's civilian government. The military declaring a state of emergency over suspect voter fraud claims.
It was a creepy thing to watch this from afar because there was still order in the streets. There were still rules. They were just way different ones. Well, yesterday, much, much closer to home, less than 1,000 miles from the tip of Florida.
We now have breaking news abroad. The president of Haiti has been assassinated.
We started getting reports that a gang of men had just broken into the home of the president of Haiti and killed him. And when an assassination happens, some rules can be much more up for debate. In a strong democracy, you follow the rules, you install the next leader. But in a weak democracy, well, sometimes in a moment like this, there are no rules. ABC's Lionel Moise is based in Miami. And Lionel, I should point out, you have the same last name as the president of Haiti. No relation. But what do we know about how this all unfolded?
Yeah, Moise is a very common last name. We are not related. But what we do know happened is in the middle of the night, a group of unidentified individuals raided his private home in Port-au-Prince, which is the capital. This was around 1 a.m. Local time, and gunned down the 53-year-old president. He was killed in that raid.
A neighbor says there was such a barrage of gunfire, it felt like an earthquake. Today, the driveway still covered in shell casings.
The first lady, Martine Moise, was also shot multiple times. She has been brought here to Miami for treatment.
It appears that one of her arms is bandaged. She has a mask over her face, and it looks like she is really just keeping still, saying very little.
Bits of information have been slowly coming out, including the interim prime minister, Claude Joseph, basically calling this a highly coordinated attack by a highly trained and heavily armed group.
They pretend that they are DEA. Drug enforcement agency, but they are not. They actually killed the president. But most of them were speaking Spanish, some were speaking English.
Late last night, we also learned from Haiti's police chief that four of the suspected killers were fatally shot by police, two others arrested. There was an apparent hostage situation where three officers were being held hostage.
Hey, what led up to this? I mean, this didn't, from people on the ground, it sounds like this did not happen in a vacuum, right?
Yeah, so there's been a lot going on. Basically, President Moise was installed after a contentious election. And so a provisional president had to be put into place for 1 year.
The opposition accusing him this year of seeking to install a dictatorship.
Now, some of his opponents have said that that 1 year is included in the time of the typical 5-year term that a president serves, basically saying that he should have been out of office. He has claimed that he still had more time and was supposed to be in power until February, and that if he was to vacate the office, this too would be jeopardizing democracy.
Haiti has long been gripped by political turmoil and unrest. It has the poorest economy in the West.
There have been ongoing protests over the past few months leading up to an election that should be happening in the fall. People saying that he should step down and that he's not a legitimate president anymore, while he has argued that leaving and vacating would sacrifice democracy in the country, which is clearly a problem that's going on right now.
Well, so then what happened? Like, is there a vice president to fill the role? Or, like, I guess I'm wondering how the government keeps control in this really sort of fragile moment.
This is a big question for a lot of people. Interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph did release a statement basically saying that he is in charge of the country right now.
And now I'm in charge, as you know, as per Haiti's constitution.
But a lot of it is up in the air. The Supreme Court Chief Justice, who would have been pivotal in this moment, recently died of COVID-19. You remember Parliament was dissolved. They were in the middle of preparing for another election. And so a lot of this is unclear as to who's going to remain in charge and whether or not it will be the interim prime minister.
Sécurité pays sous contrôle.
Today, the acting prime minister calling for calm to, quote, make sure the country does not fall into chaos.
This is a very delicate situation right now for the people of Haiti. There's a lot of suspicion of other countries or organizations who have ulterior motives or vested interests in the president not being in power.
When you attack some big interest in the country, anything can happen. But it's not how democracy should work.
This is something that had happened before, after the earthquake, accusations of groups coming in, governments coming in to help and not really helping the people, but only serving their interests. And so outside of what this means for democracy, there is definitely going to be a lot of finger pointing and people feeling uncertain about who exactly is responsible and why they would want to do this.
Well, and so then, what does that mean for the average Haitian? Like, what are we hearing anything from people on the ground as to what it is like in the country with the president dead?
Yeah, I spoke to my aunt and my uncles there, and they basically said the capital is a ghost town. People are afraid to leave their homes right now because, again, if someone from outside the country was able to fly in or infiltrate the country somehow and take out the president, which you would imagine that his home would be heavily guarded and he would be surrounded by security. I mean, that is a major concern. People just do not know what's going to happen next. My aunt gave an important perspective. She basically said even the gangs who had been out terrorizing certain areas of Haiti, and that was a major concern from citizens. Even they have been laying low since this happened,
really?
Which would make you wonder if they too don't even know if this is something that could affect them.
Right, and you can almost feel the alarm, the visceral alarm from leaders around the world as they all said, hey, everyone stay calm. There is a succession plan in place. Haiti's going to follow it. But you do not get the impression that everyone is super confident in what the next steps are. Lionel Moise in Miami, we'll be thinking of your family. Thanks so much for the reporting.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, around 6 police officers are taking gunfire every month, and that's just the city of Chicago. We're back in a bit.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
President Biden was already scheduled to meet with the mayor of Chicago yesterday as he made a trip to the Midwest. He was already expected to discuss the surge of shootings within the city and across the country. Well, yesterday morning, before they even had the chance to meet,
we need an ambulance. We got 3 PO shot.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot received word from police leaders telling her that 3 law enforcement officers had just been shot at by gunmen.
Our police officers are under siege. They're outmanned and they're outgunned.
And then, right after they parted ways across the state line in Indiana, another police officer was shot and this time killed at a federal courthouse. ABC's Alex Perez is based in Chicago. He joins us now. And Alex, let's start there in Chicago because there have already actually been a ton of officers shot there in the line of duty this year.
Yeah, you know, the police superintendent here said this latest shooting brings it to the tally to 36 Chicago police officers that have been shot or shot at just this year alone.
At 5:50 a.m. this morning, we've had 3
officer shot.
Now, to clarify, this incident that happened in Chicago happened in the early morning hours, and it was actually two federal agents, two ATF agents, and one Chicago police officer. They were undercover in an unmarked vehicle.
Officers were fired upon from the street towards the on-ramp while they were in their car on-ramping onto the freeway.
When authorities say a suspect or suspects in another vehicle opened fire on them.
All three were hit. One ATF agent was shot in the arm, the other shot in the hand, and the Chicago police officer grazed by a bullet in the back of the head.
Thankfully, all of their injuries were not life-threatening. They were hospitalized, but have since been released from the hospital. But as you mentioned, this is a big problem, gun violence here in Chicago, but it's a problem many cities across the country are dealing with right now, especially as we head into the summer months.
Right. I was going to say, so this does sound, from what we're hearing from the White House, like they are treating this like it's indicative of a larger issue of gun violence, not just in Chicago, but around the country.
Yeah, you know, in Chicago oftentimes becomes sort of the poster child for a lot of the violence that we see across the country. But this gun violence is happening in all of the major urban populations that we see.
Next to a rise in mass shootings in just a six-hour period this weekend in four U.S. cities, Austin.
And it's surging this summer.
A total of five dead, 39 wounded.
You have to remember, we're coming off of the pandemic where last summer there was, you know, many places were on lockdown. There was no one on the streets.
100 people were hit by bullets in Chicago over the holiday weekend. 18 of them didn't survive.
Now, a lot of people facing different life situations are getting back on the street, and we're seeing this increase in violence, and particularly in gun violence.
So far this year, at least 307 children under the age of 11 have been injured by gun violence, 129 killed.
So it's alarming, it's concerning, and the leaders of all these major cities, like Mayor Lightfoot here in Chicago, are trying to come up with ways to combat that. And part of that is partnering up with the federal government.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What are the options for somebody like Lori Lightfoot? Because so far, the plan in Chicago and a lot of cities has been, well, let's pass really strict gun laws. Okay, but here we are.
The solutions are there. What we need is the political will.
Correct. Really strict gun laws. But the issue also is something Lori Lightfoot has made a point of talking about.
When guns are so porous that they can come across our borders. With
she believes that the country needs to see tougher federal gun legislation.
We have to have a multi jurisdictional national solution to this horrible plague of gun violence.
And as we know, oftentimes not much develops on that front. But what we're seeing other cities, including Chicago, do is really sort of invest money in anti-violence projects, things where people are heading into communities to sort of try to get to the root of the problem.
We know summer jobs, training and recreation for young people work. They help make sure young people pick up a paycheck instead of a pistol.
But the other issue you have to remember is that many of these suspects, criminals who are carrying out these crimes are gang members who are not really looking for help. To tackle that angle, we have Chicago and other mayors partnering with the federal government, with the DEA and ATF agents, these special teams that are going to be dispatched to cities across the country to try to tackle this gun violence, to try to get the guns out of the hands of the bad guys.
Just so many examples to point to, literally, in the last few weeks and in the last several hours there in Chicago and elsewhere. Alex Perez, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
There was a ticker tape parade yesterday in Lower Manhattan. Not for the Yankees or the Giants, but for frontline workers who gave up so much to keep the rest of us alive. Nurses, doctors, hospital staff, along with teachers, bus drivers, and yes, delivery workers were all recognized here. The grand marshal was Sandra Lindsay, the nurse in Queens who got New York's first vaccine dose.
I feel so proud. Such progress has been made, and we need to just keep it going.
Which tells you how even now, the development of these COVID-19 vaccines remain the single biggest game changer the world has seen in this pandemic. Particularly these mRNA vaccines like Moderna and Pfizer, this type of technology that had been in the works for years but had never been implemented at this scale and have now proved to be more effective than anything we have ever seen before. Well, yesterday, Moderna announced that they've got a new mRNA vaccine that they're testing in clinical trials that's not even for COVID, it's for the flu. And scientists say get ready, because this is just the start of a potential medical revolution. Tara Haley is a science journalist who's written for everyone, including our partners at National Geographic. She's the author of the book Vaccination Investigation. And Tara, we see new flu vaccines every year, right? Why is this one so different?
Well, when we see vaccines every year for the flu, it's because the flu virus is sort of a master of disguise. It's constantly changing and evolving. So we see all these variants coming out with the COVID virus. Well, in this case, the flu virus, it mutates much, much faster, and it's hard to keep up with. So the problem is that we have to figure out through guesswork, basically, educated guesses, which versions of the flu virus, you know, which strains we think are going to be circulating 7 months ahead of time. With an mRNA vaccine, you can whip it up literally in a day. I mean, you can have a candidate vaccine in one day, and then you can start manufacturing them, which means we could wait all the way up until, you know, maybe a month before school, you know, the flu season hits, and then say, okay, well, which strains are actually circulating? Not which ones did we think 7 months ago were going to be circulating.
What other kind of vaccines could soon be mRNA vaccines? And what does that even mean, I guess?
Well, the whole concept between an mRNA vaccine, most people are aware that with a vaccine, you're introducing some piece of the pathogen or some, you know, or a dead version of it into the body.
Right.
And the body says, oh, intruder, and makes the, you know, builds an army of antibodies so that next time it comes along, they can fight it. Well, this is kind of like introducing a middleman, but in a good way. So say that someone's a burglar, and the way you know they're a burglar is because they have a black mask on their face. What we do is we send the instructions for how to crochet a black mask to your
that's
cells.
That's helpful. Now I understand.
Yeah, and so your cells go ahead and crochet that black mask.
This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
And then the message, you know, spontaneously self-destructs like in Mission Impossible. And it stops making the mask because it doesn't have the instructions anymore. I mean, these cells aren't very smart. But it's made enough masks that the immune system sees the mask and goes, oh, burglar, we need to make antibodies to fight it.
Antibodies wane, but the vaccine appears to teach so-called germinal cells in our lymph nodes to make more, like it does with other diseases.
So the mRNA technology could be used for all different kinds of pathogens. And if I think about some of the viruses it could be used for, RSV is one of those viruses. Another virus it might help for is herpes viruses. Another virus it might help with is, some people might recognize it as CMV. It's called cytomegalovirus. You know, could it work for dengue virus? Could it work for Rocky Mountain spotted fever? And I don't know, because that one's a tick, but it definitely opens up a lot of possibilities. And this technology can enable us to do things with that we weren't able to do before.
Are there downsides to these new types of vaccines?
Well, there are some mRNA vaccines that were developed for COVID that did not make it to the final stage, not here in the United States, but outside the US. So just the fact of being an mRNA vaccine by itself, that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be this magical, amazing vaccine that always has 95% effectiveness. I mean, we still have to do the tests and find out. The other thing is, we've been making vaccines on other types of machinery and infrastructure for so many years. This requires a different factory setup. But if it turns out that we can create factories that you can make any kind of mRNA vaccine on, and we can ultimately develop mRNA vaccines for all different kinds of diseases, and it's worth the investment to build that infrastructure, then we are looking at a much more accurate and safe type of vaccine that can be produced for all kinds of diseases.
Well, then if you had to get out a crystal ball and look 10 years into the future, is there a sense of what is going to be different about the vaccination process if this works?
10 years from now. I mean, at the speed at which things are moving, that's almost science fiction. I think another thing we'll see that we haven't discussed, mRNA technology can be used for cancer vaccines.
Really?
And so we might see new treatments in cancer. So this definitely is a new frontier in many ways. But this mRNA technology, this is the first vaccine on the market, but it's not the first time mRNA vaccines have been developed. They've been in development for 10 years.
Through a historic series of funding bills, my administration is providing roughly $10 billion to support a medical research effort without parallel.
We simply did not have the political will and the financing to make them happen.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast.
And we didn't have a disease that was so rampant that we were able to test it because it was going through the population.
Here we are, 10 months from the date when this virus hit our shore, and we've got a second 90% plus effective vaccine for the American people.
So it is important to emphasize that while this overall development of the COVID vaccine is a bit of a quantum leap in terms of blowing open the possibilities to know it can work, the actual science itself has been an iterative process over the past 10 to 15 years.
Which is why you've seen some of these scientists called out in country after country saying, you guys really changed the course of this pandemic. Tara Haley, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, where to? I don't know, any place where cab rides aren't $100 a pop. Keep the meter running. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. It was 11 years ago that a new company launched this app at the San Francisco App Show and told the audience it could now walk out the door and book a car from their phone. It was called Uber. You know where the rest of the story goes, but the story has a new twist in which users of the dominant rideshare services are now ditching them for gasp, San Francisco taxis.
It's old as new again. Taxi drivers say they're seeing an increase in business because rideshare services are getting more expensive.
Throughout San Francisco, taxi drivers are saying their ridership has suddenly spiked as prices soar for Uber and Lyft. Commuters are increasingly downloading taxi service apps, or as if the rideshare revolution had never taken place, they're just calling cabs on a phone like they used to.
Uber and Lyft have been surge pricing their rides here, which has, I think, alienated a lot of their customers.
I've noticed it where, like, you know, to go like 5 or 10 miles, it's like $60.
And critics of rideshare companies have been predicting this exact thing for years. They say the tech playbook is to offer something for way, way cheaper than anyone else, get everyone to switch over to you, drive out the old guard, and then jack up prices. But Uber and Lyft insist this is not them raising their prices, but rather just a total lack of car drivers.
Lyft acknowledged demand is outpacing supply, saying earlier this spring, as vaccines rolled out and people started moving again, we began to see the demand for rides outpace the number of available drivers.
See, when the pandemic hit, drivers could not pay someone to get in their car. Many of them went on unemployment, they started delivering food, or they just moved away. Just like every other industry, getting them back has not been as smooth as you might have expected. So those surge prices are doing their thing. They're surging, and no drivers are arriving to take advantage of these huge fares. That, economists predict, will change sooner than later.
Lyft saying, we've added thousands of drivers in the past few weeks, and it's already leading to a better rider experience.
In the meantime, the new hottest apps in San Francisco are based on this novel idea that they can hail you a taxi from your phone. One of the apps in San Francisco says the biggest thing now is to just predetermine your fare, since a big part of the anxiety of a taxi cab is seeing that meter price just creep up. So rideshares originally copied cabs, and now cabs are copying rideshares. I guess I got that straight. Start here tomorrow. Just hit subscribe. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.